Well, this is not because I want to have the last word or anything like that. Wait a minute. Oh, I do the wrong things here, yes. So coming back to what I said yesterday, I want this talk will be a cry for help to the many-body people. And I'll try to explain what problem I have, and I would want to see if there is any sort of advice on the matter. And I want to come back to this F electron system, but also to D electron systems. And I sort of firmly believe there are localized states there, and it's very important to include those localized states, and I will show maybe in a little bit more leisurely way the sort of evidence for those localized states and why they're important for the physics. And there are also the delocalized states, and this and they all connected in this sort of grand idea, going back to Bohr and Johansson about the alpha-gamma transition in cerium, that it's transition between localized and delocalized. But it's not, you know, that simple. It's more complicated. But those could be the ingredients of a sort of more a theory based on with DMFT-based theory, but there you would sort of you try to prejudice the theory. This is what I sort of understand. You should, in order to sort of make it more implementable, if you could prejudice the DMFT, then you could sort of make the calculation more tractable. So coming back to this evidences for localized states, and I sort of showed again this view graph of yesterday. In F electron systems, it was established that there are sometimes localized states that sometimes they behave as delocalized, sometimes they are part of the Fermi surface, sometimes they are not part of the Fermi surface. And there's a whole sort of literature over the last 10 years or so to establish that. And we have been doing some calculations on that based on the self-interaction correction. And I'll show you now some of the results of our calculations, which gives indications of this localized state. And then I switch to another talk to do this.
When you say that they're not at the Fermi surface, you don't mean they are band state somewhere below?
Well, no, you just try to count the number of electrons which are below the Fermi surface. Yeah. And you see then if this F state does participate to it or it doesn't. If it doesn't participate to the Fermi surface, then it's split off on the valence band, then it's a localized state.
Well, but basically, there are two kinds of electrons always. They are localized and delocalized. And those delocalized ones come from the unoccupied ones of hydrogen
balls,
because those can be
erected. You can really say one or the other.
You have both of them.
Dichotomy, you're saying?
Yeah.
Sharp
dichotomy.
By counting, yes, how many states there are. Yes, if it's localized, you can see it's not there.
For example,
the hybridization is 0.00001.
No.
Well, it's like a semiconductor band gap. There might be still, it has a gap, and there might still have some sort of hybridization. But when it comes to counting, it does not participate. Okay, so the first example I want to show is how the gamma alpha transition looks like, and so this is the phase diagram you're presumably all sort of aware of, and so you have this. So you have the alpha gamma transition at that pressure at temperature equal to zero. It's been extrapolated to occur at -7 kilobars. So the characteristics is it's an isostructure phase transition. It's a large volume collapse, and the magnetic moment gets lost. So if you do these calculations, with the localized F state, which is then represented by these calculations with the self-interaction corrected local density approximation, then you get a total energy versus volume, where the minimum corresponds with the volume of the gamma phase. Now, then you treat the F electrons with the LSD, and you have another total energy versus volume calculation. And if you make the common tangent construction with those two, then you get a transition pressure of 11 kilobars versus an experimental one of 7 kilobars, and a volume collapse corresponding to 20 kilobars at 20% versus 14 to 17%. And also note the energy difference of those two minima is very small, 3 millirydbergs. Now the thing is that here the gamma phase seemed to be well described with the F localized, with the F as a localized state, but alpha phase is more complex than just the LSD. And that is reflected in the fact that we underestimate the equilibrium volume. The equilibrium volume is slightly higher. So the thing is that here there is the theory with the F electron localized seem to be described, but the F electron is a much more complex animal here in the alpha phase and cannot sort of be described in simple LSD. So a scheme has to be found to sort of go beyond that.
Is the LSD underestimation of the alpha phase large compared to a normal LSD?
Yes, it is larger than a normal one. Yes.
What is the experimental volume?
It's 10%. How much?
For alpha.
The gamma one is spot on, and that you would did. So the thing is, so the picture really would be that when you decrease volume, that the F electron slightly becomes sort of delocalized, and we want to think in terms of it that it might be a sort of we think of it that there are two possibilities, F electron localized, delocalized, and that it dynamically fluctuates between those two possibilities. And
so you're saying the volume of the gamma phase you can get correctly with SIG?
Yes.
Within 2-3%?
No,
yes, within 2%, yes. And the volume of the alpha phase is too small.
By 10%.
It's smaller than the normal LSD error, so there is something wrong.
It's not terribly wrong. It's always a LEA always tends to an overbind.
Yeah, but it's overbinding. It's too much. It's beyond the LDA error bars.
It's not as bad as plutonium, that is 35%.
No, it's not. No.
No, it's about 3%.
Sorry. But the alpha phase, yes.
Yeah. How was that LDA calculation for the alpha phase done? It's a two-panel calculation.
Yes, this one is a two-panel calculation, and with SP in the lower panel. So we played a lot of games with this.
So you have both the 5P and the 6P.
Yes. This is the result of a two-panel calculation.
So
now the thing is.
AKR, right?
So no, LMTO.
It's two-panel LMTO.
Is it full potential?
No.
Atomic sphere approximation.
Okay. But it is a one atom per unit cell FCC, so.
Yeah, okay. But this number depends on actually how the MTO calculation is done.
Yes.
If we're doing it one panel, you'd be completely.
Okay, no, but the point is.
You still have the same minima difference, but the lattice parameters go.
Right. It depends where you put your panel. We actually looked at that.
No, it's not that. But the problem is that you are underestimating because the curves can shift in this way, most of them. So at that point, gamma phase is also not very well described, but in volume it's about 4%, too small. But the alpha phase, of course, remains the same.
Yeah.
But you get the shift to the left.
Well, it depends if you put your 5P or 6P, and you get quite
different.
Yes. Yes. And also
one
depends.
You always have 5P. You do one panel calculation, you have 5P. And they are very crucial. You have to have
them. I agree with that.
Yes. The result depends stronger on 5P. But in one panel, you take 5P, not 6P.
Yes.
But in two panels, you have both.
Well, and there's been recently MFT calculations putting the 6P, so, you know.
Well, we have 6P here in the two panel.
Yes, it's a. Yeah.
But that, of course, improves gamma phase.
But in principle, I should think of the calculation as fully converged. If I try to enlarge my basic set further, the results are not going to change. You know that for sure?
Well, the thing is that things will change if you. But this is a.
So how fully converged is your
The bottom line is you should do KKR, I think. But it's the energy dependence also which kills you. The linearization kills you too, and it's.
So we did calculations in two panel, one panel with SPD, lower panel, SPD, SPDF, and we published it all. It is very sensitive to the number of basis functions.
And you cannot define in any way some conversions to the calculation as you add more and more basis sets?
Well, you have, we did.
And then?
But this is what I said, the linear will switch.
That it will switch. This will become lower. But the major point is.
The correct answer.
And that's what we
found. Okay.
The major point is that those two minima will always be within 10 millirittbergs from each other. They will. You know, this is 3 millirittbergs difference here.
And if you do double pi, you can do double pi, so you have double number of basis functions.
I think KKR would be it's the linearization which is also affecting you with it, those
because the bands are so narrow, you're saying, and
there is variation. But first of all, there's the 5P6P issue that you have to sort of continuously describe, and so.
But that's no problem. You put one energy for the 5P and one energy for 6P.
No, but the thing is that if you have here your logarithmic derivative, and here you have the energy, then at the resonance, your logarithmic derivatives blow up. And here are where the 5P P bands occur, and then sugar. So you and your valence bands are here roughly.
This is the phase shift.
The logarithmic derivative, the phase shift would be so you have the 5p, the 6p, and your valence band lies in the middle of the thing. Now, so what do you do? Are you going to expand with respect to this? Or are you going to expand with respect to those, because you're using a linear scheme, so you have only one basis function per orbit. But the thing is, you could put a panel around here, that is then this, and then you take then the 6Ps then to, and then you have the choice, shall I take it as a low wave or as an intermediate wave? If you do this screened LMT. So you have to make a decision here. The most consistent one would be an intermediate one, because then you would be able to use an ENU which belongs here. If you would then use a low wave, your ENU would be very high up, because it would have to describe the resonance here, and then you sort of extrapolate to here. But it does call for something where you take properly into account the radial the energy dependence of the basis function, and this is what the KKR does. The KKR is an energy dependent KKR matrix where for each of those energies you have properly considered.
What is the Fermi level here?
Sort of here. Okay. So roughly halfway between those two things. Yeah, but on this scale here, it's halfway and it doesn't change. But this is a sort of generic problem for.
And I don't care about
so. Okay, so that is. But right, okay. So you do have a very an energy difference which is extremely small, and but then if you look at your densities of states, then they are very different, and this is then the density of states when you would have the local density result. There are four electrons, so this is the Fermi energy. Four electrons are occupying those bands here, where you have in green the D bands, and you have a substantial F contribution, which is hybridizing with the Ds. So if you then look at the Fermi surface, then you would see under that four electrons. When it would be localized, and that is then the density of states for the gamma phase, then there is then one band split off, which contains one electron, and then there's sitting three electrons under the Fermi surface. And what you see is that there is much weaker hybridization of the Fs with the Ds. This is only a very low peak, and also the Fs have been slightly shifted away, the unoccupied Fs slightly shifted away from the Fermi energy because they have been orthogonalized to this localized one. Even though those densities of states look sort of very, very different, total energy differences are very small. And again, we want to see this as the two extreme cases.
Now, for alpha cerium, if you are, the sig tells you that the F electron is not localized.
So at the volume of the alpha phase,
so
yes.
When you say that it's LSDA, you don't force the LSDA by hand. You no. Make LSDA sig, but the sig itself is smart enough to know that in alpha, the electron likes to be itinerant.
Yes,
is that
yes, yes.
You have to go by energy, so it becomes the sig becomes unfavorable.
You can constrain the calculation still in those volumes.
Okay.
You can still constrain the calculations to go through in those volumes.
I mean, because sig depends on the orbitals, and then
yes.
You can
you
do can. Different orbitals and then
okay.
Okay.
Are you
so you
the
always
energy?
Have to test it with respect to the absolute minimum. And then you have to choose an LSD because it becomes lower.
Okay.
The idea you would become partially localized.
Right, sure.
So
we cannot do because we only have
five. That's what
the
MFT
does.
This
is not... Yes. So you can also do KKS here where the concentrations of the average, you can go continuously from 1 to 0 at electron, and that will give you perhaps minimum equilibrium effects. But that's what we are doing.
So
anyway, DMFT is just multi-configuration interaction.
Yes,
you would take the localized and the delocalized, and we put with different weights. That's
yes,
what it
yes,
is.
Yes,
yes. Can we do that?
Yes.
So in KKSF, the minimum would be the same, that you have concentration of alpha phase, so you have localized this, and you would vary the concentration function of temperature as well, for the minimum, at every temperature.
The only difference is that when people do multi-configuration interaction, they relax the basis set as well. While in the MFT, the way that it's currently implemented, it splits your basis set and just adjust the occupation of a different configuration. So the ideal marriage would be to take the two methods. They're relaxing the wave function,
yes,
and
exactly.
We allow the multiple occupations, then we have the best method.
Yes.
How do you determine the
dynamical self-consistency condition, in some sense, ends up telling you how much of each you have.
So the weight is defined
self-consistency.
The weight is defined self-consistency.
Yes.
The weight of this is what we want. This is
what we are doing with KKS.
This is what we want to do. So the thing is, so we would take a volume, and then the dynamical mean field would then tell us for that particular volume how much of each of the LSD and the sig LSD get mixed together. That's possible.
Yeah, that's the spirit of it.
Uh-huh.
Except that we don't have the relaxation of the basis set. You see, when you do a multi-configuration interaction calculation, you do two things. You allow the probabilities of the different configurations to relax, and you also allow the wave function of each Slater determinant to relax. What the current implementations of the MFT do, they don't allow the relaxation of the basis functions. They just fix the basis set, the kind of Slater determinant that you have once and for all,
okay.
And then they optimize the configuration.
Yes.
What you're doing is you're looking for each individual Slater determinant, the best wave functions that you can pulling
yes,
that.
Yes.
So one needs to combine these two things.
But when the local density is recalculated, the density is changed.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Yes, but it's still all this later. I mean, still all this later determinants are in the same basis. The nice thing about that is that for the gamma, which is more localized, you have more localized functions.
Yes.
For the alpha, which is less localized, you have more delocalized functions.
Oh, okay.
This
yeah.
kind of ability has not yet been built in the MFT codes. Even we make full subconsistent with exchange correlation potential, but the basis set is still fixed. We don't use a set of things for one and for the other. One can add more flexibility.
The phi, I mean, are the same for the...
Well, in LMPO, you have phi and phi
dots. Don't try to find the phi.
Right.
So,
in principle, we could, but we haven't done it. So that, I think there's still room to improve in both directions.
I think this guy Bernard has actually changed his work.
But once and for all, I mean, it's
yeah.
No, I as well.
But we could take over a machinery which already exists. Is that what you're saying with modifications to do this?
Well, I'm saying that at least conceptually, there's two. I see some things that can be improved, and I see some things that can improve. But go on with your talk. I mean, this was just a comment. No?
Okay. Continuing again on this line of this localized states. In those rare earth compounds, there are a lot of pressure measurements, and those equations of states are seeing a lot of anomalies. And in the cerium phosphide and in general in cerium pycnites, there are sort of two transitions possible. There is a localization, delocalization transition, but also a structural transition from a sodium chloride to a cesium chloride structure. And the point here is that I want to show is that we can calculate that those localization energy are calculated with the same accuracy or inaccuracy as the structural properties. So when we look at the cesium phosphide, where we find then as the state with the lowest energy, the one where the F electron is localized, and the first transition would be is that the F electron becomes delocalized, and that is then a transition within the same structure, B1 structure, and then we're predicting then that at a higher pressure there will be then another transition from a B1 structure to a B2 structure. And so we investigated this through the cerium monopycnite series, and actually the order of this transitions, that first is a localization, delocalization transition, changes. If you go through the series, and for the heavier pycnites, for the cerium bismuth and the cerium antimonide, we're finding that there is first a structural transition, and only second comes the localization, delocalization transition at much higher pressures. There's only a limited amount of experimental data available, but for the cerium phosphide, we see experimentally those two pressures, and our theoretical calculations are in reasonable agreement with it. Also, for the cerium arsenic, we only have one transition pressure, and also experimentally, there is only one seen. The experimental data for the very high pressures in the antimonide and the bismuth are not available. Also, those volumes for the low and experiment, the low and for the low and the high volume phases are in fairly good agreement. And this is then in another sort of evidence of these localized states in the rare earths, and that they matter a lot, is that when you talk to a rare earth physicist or something like that, he will always categorize or try to categorize any sort of rare earth material in terms of if it's divalent, is it trivalent. That's sort of his first reference point about the rare earth. And that comes about because the rare earths in the atoms, they're all divalent, and you put them in the solid and most of them become trivalent with some exceptions. And those exceptions are the sort of interesting materials. And the question is, why do those exceptions happen towards the end of the series? The exceptions, the systems which become divalent are in ytterbium compounds, or sometimes also in tulmium, and also in the europium and samarium compounds. And with our scheme of localized states, we are able to calculate the valency by just looking at the atomic number and we're subtracting out the number of core electrons which we considered in the calculations and the number of localized states which we considered in calculations. And then we have a certain number of electrons left, two or three. And those electrons have still been expanded in sp, d, and f electrons. So we can have an f manifold split, because the f manifold can then be split in localized states and delocalized band-like states, which are treated with the LSDA. And so if you do that and we choose the two possibilities, the divalent and the trivalent one, then we find that at the beginning of the series, it's heavily trivalent, those energies are big, and we move towards the middle, becomes divalent. The crosses refer to our calculations for the sulfides, and the circles refer to our calculations for the elemental rare earths, and the dashed line are values that Bohr-Johansson deduced from experiments, and they have sort of nearly the status of experiment. And you see that is in extremely good agreement with those experimental values. Then we see the jump here at half filling, and for the gadolinium onwards, again, extremely trivalent, and then the valency energy differences decreases, and it becomes then divalent in the ytterbium one. So now if you then use those valencies, and you then look at the equilibrium lattice constants or the equilibrium ASA spheres, then we see when you compare our calculations, which are the circles, with the crosses, which are the experiments for the sulfides, that we do reproduce this lanthanide contraction and also this jump there in the lattice constant when the system becomes divalent, and that's the usual way to deduce if a system is divalent. We have a simple interpretation for all this, and the simple interpretation is in terms of densities of states. And also highlighting the sort of dual nature of the F electrons. So the Mickey Mouse picture of the density of states in the metals in the divalent trivalent states is as follows. In the divalent state, since you only occupied one more extra F electron, your unoccupied F level is well separated from the Fermi energy. So you have then as valence band states consisting of sp and d electrons. And unoccupied F states separate from Fermi energy. When you have trivalent one, the Fermi energy, the F bands straddle the Fermi energy. In the sulfides, a rather similar picture. Divalent one, F electrons again separated from the Fermi energy. Now you will have a gap because on the sulfides they are 2-, divalent is 2+, so you have full band situation with the gap. And in the trivalent one, the F levels are sitting at the Fermi energy. So now if you start filling up the bands and you start from cerium towards the middle, what is happening is that in the trivalent state, you're filling those F resonance comes down in energy, and you start filling up more. There are more S states available than your trivalent count. And at one stage, it becomes more favorable to localize one extra F electron. So this is this stage you reach at the half filling. So coming back, so if you go through the series like this, the F states, the unoccupied F states, they start coming down in energy, and you occupy one more than you can localize one more than you count.
And isn't that the usual trend that as you move always towards the center of the periodic series, the level goes down?
Yes, yes. So there's nothing more than that.
Okay.
And this is.
So the important thing is that here, because of spin orbit coupling, the shell gets interrupted in the middle.
The exchange splitting, yes, you have a half-filled band at the middle, and then the trend continues again.
Okay.
There's nothing more to it than that. So if you translate what I was telling you to numbers, and you look at this energy difference between divalent and trivalent, and you then just look at the difference between those unoccupied F electrons, between the divalent and the trivalent one, and if this becomes sort of bigger than a number of 0.7 or something like that, then all the systems here, they become divalent. So we found this test. That's Yes. So it's not favorable to have more than 0.7, 0.8 F band electrons, in other words. So if the calculation would tell, the trivalent calculation would tell you that you have only that you have 0.7 or 0.8 band like F electrons, then this is not a stable situation. Then it says, okay, I want to localize that one, and it becomes trivalent. Gosh. So if now you do the same analysis for the actinides, then because you're dealing now with the 5F wave functions, and they are orthogonal to the 4F ones, and so they are less localized than the 4Fs. So this localization energy has become smaller, and that you see in this curve. So the energies to localize become much smaller. That's one, if you compare it on the scale of the rare earths. Second point is that there is not only just divalent or trivalent involved, there is also tetravalent, which sticks up its neck. And here there are some energy differences between a tetravalent and a trivalent. And that is then the divalent tetravalent. So there are more configurations coming in, and they're all sort of lying much closer in energy. Energy differences between those configurations have become smaller. The trend is still that for the heavy actinides, it is all divalent, which is sort of in agreement with what the experimentalists have deduced. Here at the beginning, we find that they are band-like, it's LSDA, but things are very complicated with the plutonium. The curium, I will show maybe some picture of that too, but let's first go to the plutonium.
Yes, you say the localized side, the thing should be divalent, right? The electron is bound up to americium, right? What happens in americium?
Americium, it's trivalent.
Why?
Wait, I have to have a picture of this.
Yeah, okay. Right. So it has 6 electrons, from. Remind me, in americium, trivalent means 6 electrons. In americium, how many electrons you have?
It's one more than plutonium.
Okay, so it's
where's the plutonium? I think I have to switch to another talk. Okay, here the americium. Okay, so those are then, that's 3, 4, that must be 5, that must be 6, and that is 7.
Are you predicting 7?
No, 6. 6 is the one which is predicted here. 6, which is the... But again, you see, all those things are coming close in energy, and again, it's... Yes, it's 7 is close here.
And the volume comes out correctly. Where is
the volume comes out? Yes. So here the. Sorry, I have a table. There is a table with the volumes.
With F6, do you get the right volume?
Yes. I have not combined those talks. here's the volumes. Okay, so those are the volumes. The americium, we have a volume which is 8% too big. Curium is 1.2% too big. Is it berkelium is 6% too big? Is that okay? That's californium, and steinium is too small, and something like that. So our big problem is, of course, is the plutonium.
Yeah, but also americium you have a problem.
It's 8%. But this is the same as here.
And I'm surprised because I was expecting the six to do fairly well for americium, because in americium I think that electron is really localized, and that's what you're making a nicely localized configuration, which should not be in the bonding.
But I'm not so sure. I mean, Ericsson has done calculations for americium F electrons all in the car.
Yes.
And we actually repeated LDA plus U calculation.
Yes.
We actually repeated such calculation. It doesn't give a perfect value.
So you claim there's 8%?
8% is a bit big, I think, compared to these calculations.
That's just over 2% in lattice calls. It's just.
Sorry?
That is just over 2% in lattice constant.
Yeah,
that's it.
Volume.
You see, I think the problem, I mean, we looked into americium as well. I think the problem is that the last electron is barely bound. So sometimes when for example, if you try to put it as core, you find that the potential does not really bind.
Okay. Yes. So the tetrahedron one was close by.
Right. So the bottom line is that it's not completely correct to say that they are all localized.
Okay. That's experimentally, they are localized. Your theory has a problem. That experimentally, we know that F electron is localized from many sources. The fact that you cannot reproduce it doesn't mean that it's not localized. Means you need better theoretical method.
But here in this thing, they are sort of well.
Well, it's a minimal.
It's also, I don't know, it's also rather shallow minimum, so I don't know. Okay, all those calculations in the table have been done in the same manner.
Right.
So maybe you, this is not difficult. Maybe you can still invoke an LMTO problem. Or it's a more serious problem. It's maybe hard to say.
Yeah.
But if
So can you repeat again your sick calculation for americium? Gives
a volume which is 8% too big. So showing the table again. Where's the table? Here's the table again. So this is the volume. It's 8% too big. But then if you go to curium, then things become simpler. All those states with different localization, they start separating out. And so it could be that with americium, you have maybe to do something slightly more complicated than just this trivalency. And again, this relationship between number of occupied band-like F electron states and valency seems to hold. So at the end of the series, the number of band-like F electrons becomes bigger than about 0.7 or so, and those are then the systems which are then divalent. So that holds also for the actinides. And this. Yeah, and so we also looked at some compounds and the uranium palladium 3 compound where it's well known that the F electron is localized, and we find a situation where we have two localized F electrons. And we look then as a function of concentration with some supercell calculations how that changes from this F2 to an F1 situation in the uranium platinum 3. This F electron gets delocalized, and on the basis of that, we predict that if you put uranium palladium 3 under pressure, you might see a delocalization and maybe heavy fermion behavior of this uranium palladium 3 compound at 25 gigapascal. Okay, so this thing about localization, I think I want to stop here for those rare earths, but it also happens for the in transition metals and transition metal oxides, and an example which I want to show is IPCO. Maybe I should switch to another talk here. So the yttrium, barium, 2, copper, 3, oxygen, 7. And the issue with this compound is there a sort of uniform way to describe the transition from the insulator in yttrium, barium, 2, copper, 3, oxygen, 6 to metallic behavior in yttrium, barium, 2, copper, 3, oxygen, 7. And in yttrium, barium, 2, copper, 3, oxygen, 7, it's well known that LSD calculations in around the Fermi energy do give a fairly good representation of the electronic structure. And
compared to what?
Well, compared to, for example, experiments here with respect to a fairly good, I said. I don't say, didn't say perfect.
Can I ask you a slightly off-topic question? The band formed by oxygen orbitals in the plane that are perpendicular to a copper oxygen bond, I'm talking about oxygen orbital perpendicular to a copper oxygen bond in the plane.
In the some pi orbitals, you mean?
Yeah, I guess you call them pi orbitals.
Yes.
In the plane, how far below the Fermi energy would those be?
I think the normal thing of the LSD have a few electron volts, I think. They are not at the fermion. They're several electron. I know there is an issue there about it because there are some people who calculated them to be. Oh, you calculated it.
Well, I assume.
I assume. But it was some other work of some quantum chemist.
Yeah, early on. Yeah, I'm just wondering the current view is how far below the Fermi level are you supposed to be in this material, for example?
You know? Well, the current view has not changed for some time, so if you take still.
Because if the quasi-particle weight of those states is very small, the fact that we don't see them in experiment doesn't mean they're not.
Yeah, sure. But the current view has not changed since 1994, and when people.
Which are those bands? That's the Fermi surface.
This is the Fermi surface here.
The E and B are because of the bilayers.
Yes.
And the C.
The C is coming from the chain. This is the chain band which occurs in the gamma. In the gamma Y direction here, the chain
the
band. It's a stick.
What's
that? The stick. Here, and all those four pieces have been seen, but with different experiments. Photo emission. Has photo emission seen that this
yes,
bifurcation?
By.
Overdope, that is oxygen 6, you mean? No.
7 plus.
I'm not sure if they can overdope this, but
no.
Overdope cooperates. There are calculations.
Yeah, so I'm not showing any.
Well, it's not
that
rigid shape.
I know.
No, it isn't, but if you shift it down, you did some calculations. Isn't it verified at 7.1?
I think I missed the point. Did you say that the bilayer splitting was seen in photo emission?
Yes.
But not an optimal doping.
Yeah, not optimal doping. Overdoped.
At the beginning, there was
it's not seen in underdoped.
It's not seen in underdoped. I remember that.
It's
seen
at the
underdoping.
This confirmed.
I thought it was only over.
We had a talk here.
Yeah, but I couldn't remember if he had it all the way to the optimal doping.
So again, we will consider various combinations of various scenarios of localized states, and so So we will consider divalent copper, so that is, we would localize 9 of the D states, and the remaining 2 copper D states would be, the 2 states would be treated as band states, and a trivalent one in here, we would also consider a non-magnetic solution where you would have 4 states localized degenerately in the spin-up and the spin-down channels, and then 3 states are available for band formation. And so you can also then play around with possible symmetries of the whole thing. Is that if you consider configurations where you localize 9 or 8, then various possibilities, either you try to maximize the spin moment, the Hund's first rule, or you could once look at solutions which are non-magnetic, and also you can play with the symmetry depending on which of the EGs you want to localize. And so for the yttrium, barium, 2, copper, 3, oxygen, 6, if you now take the ionic configuration, which consists then of yttrium 3+, barium 2+, then 2 coppers in the planes and the copper oxygen 2 plane to be 2+, and the copper in the chain to be copper 1+, and the oxygen 2-, then you find an insulating behavior with a large semiconducting gap. Now, the localized states of the copper chains are lying here in this red peak, well separated from the bottom of the valence band. Now, if you then would change the number of localized states in the chain from 10 of them to only 8 of them, then what we see is that weight which was here, part of the weight which was here, has moved up here at the top of the valence band, and the other weight has gone below the scale here, but we still maintain an insulating behavior. So it's a configuration which is different from the ionic configuration, which now involves in the chain trivalent copper, which is still giving rise to an insulating behavior. And actually, this turns out to be energetically the state with the lowest energy. So we have now sort of changed the number of valence electrons in here. Now, if you move to 6.5, then the same configuration, which was giving you the insulating behavior in 6, still maintains an insulating behavior in 6.5. And that is then just because you just neutralize the thing, you have reduced the number of states because you have taken, you have increased the oxygen contents, but you, on the other hand, that has been compensated by the number of electrons. But also you can find configurations where both are now trivalent, the copper planar is trivalent and the copper chain are trivalent, and that gives you a metallic behavior. So, but just changing the valencies, you can go from metallic to insulating behavior. And this is then the table of our results for oxygen 6, 6.5, and 7. And those are the configurations which you considered in the copper planes and the copper chain. And this is with respect to the those energy differences with respect to the state with the lowest energy. We find that for oxygen 6, which is now insulating with a gap of 0.3 electron volt, that in the copper plane we have a divalent copper, and in the copper chain a trivalent one. If you go to oxygen 6.5, then the state with the lowest energy is a metallic state, where in the copper where in the copper plane and in the copper chain we have a trivalent coppers. And then going to the oxygen 7, then we do find also the same configuration as in the 6.5. So in this, with those calculations, we describe then that this transition from this metal insulated transition would have to do with the delocalization transition of the copper dx squared minus y squared oxygen 2px and 2py. So it's that would be the sort of description. Another thing that those localized, another system where the localized states do play a role are the manganites. And sort of to wrap it up, I briefly show some results of those manganites. the lanthanum, the magnets of interesting behavior because of the colossal magnetoresistance, which occurs in when you dope the lanthanum compound with about 0.3 or so of calcium. At both ends of the series, the systems are insulator, and they are described in terms of manganese 4 plus and manganese 3 plus. And in the cartoon-like language is that in the calcium manganese oxygen 3 plus, you have the T2G shell fully occupied and the system is a cubic one. The lanthanum manganese oxygen 3, you have an extra electron, it goes into the EG band, and this is where all the physics comes from, the Young-Teller distortion, and all the exciting physics, and also when you then would alloy it with calcium, then you have all the effects of double Zener, a double exchange occurring, which have to do with the physics of this EG electron. That sort of cartoon can be reproduced by the self-interaction correction. So, can be reproduced by the self-interaction correction. So if you look at calcium, manganese, oxygen 3, we find that valency, the most stable situation where we have the three electrons in the T2G subband occupied. We tried some other configurations and they are highly away from an energy. So only occupying two T2G electrons is a solution which is 46 milliard bucks away, and occupying more is even further away in energy. And likewise in the lanthanum, and also we get the correct, with this we also get the correct magnetic ordering, the antiferromagnetic 2G type structure. And in the calcium and in the lanthanum material too, we obtain the correct valency in the sense that we occupying now the three T2G electrons plus one of the EG ones, and it's the 3Z squared minus R squared, which gives you the lowest energy solution. But one of the interesting things of this manganite is its orbital ordering. And so if you look here in a sort of very schematic way, how this orbital ordering looks like, the full black dots are the manganeses, and those and the oxygens around it are then distorted. And this oxygen here has moved away. Those oxygens have come closer together. Those have come closer together. Those have been moved away. And that could give rise to some orbital, the structural distortions could give rise to some orbital ordering. And you sort of can investigate now all the possibilities of orbital ordering, going from antiferromagnetic orbital ordering to ferromagnetic orbital ordering for specific spin structures, going to in the antiferromagnetic structure and in the ferromagnetic structure. So you can investigate two of the sort of variables in there. We do it for the given experimental structure because we're using the spherical ASA approximation. And our calculations, again, find that the state with the lowest energy gives an antiferromagnetic spin structure with antiferromagnetic orbital ordering. And the orbital ordering is in such a way that it sort of minimizes the overlap between the EG orbitals and the adjacent oxygen P orbitals. It would localize then the EG orbitals which are pointing to the oxygens which are further away. And then the energy scales are such that the calculations indicate that the orbital ordering energies with respect to the spin energies are such that the spin energies would be a smaller energy scale than the orbital ordering ones. And so in terms of the densities of states, is that this is the situation with the density of states of the most favorable scenario with the orbital ordering. It has the biggest band gap, and also if you look at the decomposed density of states, it would minimize the hybridization between the manganese D and the oxygen Ds. So this concept of localized states, you can do a lot of things with it, but a lot of things you cannot do with it. And And the idea would be now to find a way of incorporating this in the dynamocomine field to sort of correct some of the shortcomings, such as maybe the alpha phase, maybe dealing with the plutonium and so, but also can we get to heavy fermion behavior with this, if we, because heavy fermion behavior is usually in hand-waving way interpreted as fluctuation between localized and delocalized states and things like that. And so my question to the sort of many-body people is that could we make some sort of progress by further developing this? Okay, thanks.
For the manganite case, are you saying that SIC improves or actually qualitatively changes the manganese 4 plus and manganese 3 plus things?
The manganese 3 plus, it reproduces that. That's a sort of hand waving thing that people use, and it reproduces this.
Does LSD fail?
LSD fails in. Well, LSD, where is the LSD? I don't. I don't know, I can't remember which one. Some do not give a card.
You can't choose which EG or
order. You would have no way of describing all of the law ordering.
Okay. So is there a local Young Teller, a visible local ordering?
Yes, it's a big one. It's a big one. It's a big Young Teller distortion. And the thing is but the whole thing about this Young Teller distortion is was a chicken and egg situation. Is that is it orbital ordering which gives rise to Young Teller distortion, or is it the opposite way around? But also the orbital ordering is a bit controversial. There has been some indication that it might exist from some X-ray work of Savatsky and company, but it's heavily dependent on the interpretation, so I do not know if everybody accepts it. You know, it might maybe better the situation now.